Today on Through the Wire, I bring you SC Moatti. SC is an author, entrepreneur, investor, and founding partner of Mighty Capital, a Silicon Valley venture capital fund. Previously, she built tools at Facebook, Nokia, and Electronic Arts, and has translated these experiences into an investment firm that focuses on making products that count. Apparently, she's good at it. As Andrew Chen, one of Uber's top executives and entrepreneur, says, SC is a genius at making mobile products people love. This conversation was very wide-ranging, touched upon the entrepreneurial crossroads of art and science, dangerous beauties of social media, building worldly products, and much, much more. I hope you enjoy this episode of Through the Wire, and please check in with her work at Mighty Capital. Welcome Through the Wire. I'm Jeremy Strike. This is SC Moatti, managing partner at Mighty Capital. SC, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It's exciting.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. So let's start this out. It's a rainy Wednesday back in Paris when you were little. What were you doing? If you were in school, you know, what was your favorite subject and what was your least favorite subject?
Yes. So yes, I grew up downtown Paris. My favorite subject in school, I was very, very nerdy in school. So my favorite subjects were both mathematics and ancient Greek.
Okay.
I actually never studied English in school.
Huh. And
I studied many other languages, German, Latin, ancient Greek, Russian.
But not English. Wow.
No English.
Huh. And then you picked that up as you came over to America or through media or how?
Before that, I spent some time in the UK. I was with a family near Manchester in a place called Stoke-on-Trent, mm-hmm. Which is where Wedgwood manufacturing is. So very, very like manufacturing, industrial. And I learned English by being basically dropped into this family, not speaking a word of English. And so I really learned like a baby in my teenage. And then the spelling and grammar I learned because I spent a whole summer reading line by line and loving an English grammar book. I told you I was very nerdy.
I mean, it's no surprise that you learned by total immersion because that's the best way to do it. So then you came over, you lived in the UK, you're fairly international and came to the States for college.
Yes, I got my, actually I studied electrical engineering back in France. And mm-hmm. then I moved here to get my MBA and I've been here ever since.
Yeah. And so, from my research, I saw you went to Stanford for your master's and mm-hmm. shortly thereafter, you have a very eclectic, career history. You know, I saw that you worked at Electronic Arts and Nokia and very, forward-thinking companies, and just wondering, you know, as an electrical engineer, how did you make that transition and why did you make that transition?
Yeah, so, you know, immediately after my engineering master's, I realized that I was never going to be a great engineer. Mm-hmm. I was a lot more interested in putting making technology invisible. Hmm. And putting it to use for people and for business. And so getting my MBA was a way for me to get into business. And when I graduated from business school, I started my career as a product manager. And I worked for a number of companies, like you mentioned, Electronic Arts, Nokia, ultimately also Facebook. I'm sure we'll talk about that. Mm-hmm. And was mostly product or business owner at these companies.
And so I've heard that, you know, you have your book, we're recording this in a video, you have your book in the background. So I was just looking at, actually hadn't heard about it until today, but as you know, a startup founder, I'm going to pick it up. It's very applicable. It's called Mobilized for the audience. And one of the people who commented on it, her name's Kira. She's the CMO of Lyft, I think. Correct me
if
I'm wrong.
She moved on, but yeah.
Okay. And then she talks about how, you know, she says SC is something along the lines of top notch at pairing art and science together. And is that, well, can you say more on that? Why do you see the world that way?
Yes, that's a great question. I wish more people would ask me that, because I totally believe that everything in our life is this balance, you know, the yin and yang of art and science. Mm-hmm. So what you'll find in my book and in many of the talks I give is, hey, you know, if you want to do something really, really well, you start with the scientific way. So you measure everything, you instrument, you optimize, you put, you know, everything you do into a funnel, whether it's for your business or your life. But then at some point, that approach that's so popular in Silicon Valley, it really gets diminishing returns. And so you need to really think outside the box. So for example, thinking outside the box, you know, I say like the scientific approach to pretty much everything is you have a decision tree and you eliminate stuff step by step. So you, in other words, everything you do is sort of driving a funnel. And so the artistic way to do that is say, well, let's, instead of thinking about a funnel, think outside the funnel, right? And so I have a lot of even with my team, like, let's think outside the funnel. We do that a lot.
That's amazing. It reminds me a little bit of I'm reading a book on design thinking, and it's totally not what, you know, for the people listening, what you, it's not, you know, artistry, it's design as a science and how to build a company.
Yeah. You know, there's most companies that are older, like the sort of the older economy, the non-Silicon Valley economy, operates more as an art than as a science. They're of course, they're very data driven and they measure everything, but they also recognize that if they want to stay in the game, they need to, you know, shake the trees, reinvent themselves a little bit. Most Silicon Valley companies I found start with this super scientific approach. And then as they grow, they realize like, you know, we need to think outside the funnel. We need to reinvent different things. We need to take a new product out. We need to, you know, if you're an employee, you need to switch career, things like that.
Right. So would you say to be, this is a bit of a self-indulgent question, but to be a successful company, successful, whatever that means, you have to be somewhere, you know, in between an artist and a scientist or artist and an entrepreneur?
So yes and no. It's not in between, because in between is sort of a way to be neither, but it's alternating. So, and I, you know, I actually was talking to some entrepreneurs yesterday about, you know, my book and how do you build a great product. And I'll just give you an example. It's easier. And one of the things I say is your product, if you want it to be successful, it has to have a wow factor somehow. But how do you identify this wow? And so this entrepreneur was like, how do you measure it? Like, what's the metric for the wow? And the metric for the wow is wow. You know, like when I'm talking to you and if I'm just, nodding my head, I say, there's no wow there. Mm-hmm. If I'm talking, you know, if you're telling me something, I'm like, wow, that's what you do. Oh, that's so interesting. That's so cool, right? This emotional reaction, it totally skips consciousness, right? That's the wow factor. And you really need to have that to build a great product. So the, you know, scientific versus artistic approach, you need to balance them. So you say for like 3-6 months, 1 year, however long it takes, I'm going to move towards being more scientific. I'm going to instrument, I'm going to measure, I'm going to optimize. And then at some point, I'm going to see diminishing returns from that approach. That's when I know I have to move the balance towards thinking outside the funnel.
Hmm. Do you have any examples that come to mind of, you know, some, you know, portfolio company of yours that's doing that, or at Facebook, Nokia, like how did they get that wow factor?
Yeah, I can. Oh, the wow factor or the artistic, like, well, thinking outside both. The funnel?
Either or.
Okay. Yeah, I'll give you a very simple example. An example from real estate, actually. You know, there's not a lot of more boring industries than real estate. It's very ancient. I think it's fascinating and I love it, but a very ancient industry. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the statistics and you try to optimize people buying houses and stuff, on average, people in the US buy a house once every 5 years. So if you're a company like Zillow or Trulia, you're trying to build a service, like a high velocity consumer service around this, it's really difficult, right? It's like, hey, great to see you for 30 days or 90 days. Now see you in 5 years. Not a great business. So think about a wow factor where how much would you like to know the value of the house you live in? Probably you'd like to know that, right? And especially if you own your house. And how much do you think your listeners want to know the value of the house their boss lives in, or their ex-boyfriend or girlfriend? Like, oh, all the time. What about the house next to that, right? So if you introduce a, you know, slightly inflated value of a house, which many people know as the Zestimate, all of a sudden you get a very, very addictive service that people go and check out, like, wow, the house, you know, of my neighbor is increasing faster than mine. And why is that? And did you see, like, the house of my boss increased this, you know, this past week? That's, I hate it. You know, whatever it is, it's completely addictive. And that's what I call a wow factor. It's so unexpected that in a real estate environment, you'd find something so, like, delightful and addictive. And if you can do that in real estate, you know, you can do that for pretty much any industry.
Mm. So what would you say to, you know, maybe a critic who's, you know, there's people that are very critical of, like, and I'm included, actually, of, like, social media and, you know, Instagram and companies like that, and how they leverage this wow factor to ensnare people. You know, you'll get sucked into a hole for many hours because they're able to really impress you and tell these amazing stories.
Yeah. So I think we're in Silicon Valley a little bit jaded about all that social media overload that we're getting. But again, I was talking to that group of entrepreneurs and, you know, same conversation. Now, one of them said, you know, I remember when I first joined Facebook, I spent almost a day looking at people's profiles because I had not connected with them for, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. And I just went through all of their profiles and I discovered so many things about what they were up to. Mm-hmm. And that's the power of, you know, this level of connection. It really changed people's lives. And so now we're saying, like, oh, I'm tired of it, you know. But at the same time, think about the time before Facebook. Like, this, there's a level of magic there that's just so special, so unique. And if you think about your experience on Facebook versus my experience on Facebook versus any of your listeners' experience on Facebook, nobody gets the same experience, right? It's completely personalized. I mean, how magic is that? Mm-hmm. You know? So the critic, I mean, I'm not ignoring the critic, right? The critic is, oh, now they're using their data to make money off of me. Okay, so let's look at the concerns around privacy, right? Like, what are the risks, right? People say privacy, what are the risks? The risks are three kinds. One is a person is going to use my information, two, a corporation, and three, a government. And so we have different answers for each. Like, number one, a person, we all are very clear, like, we don't want identity theft. So, you know, if there are some issues with hacking on Facebook or other services, that's just bad, right? Now, the next thing is corporations. Well, we don't like to admit it, but we do like it when corporations access our information. We don't like to admit it, I get it, right? But I prefer a good ad over a bad ad. I prefer a free service over a paid service. And I'm pretty sure at 98% of the population is in that situation as well. So what it tells us is, even though we don't like to admit it, we're okay with corporations accessing our data. Mm-hmm. And then the last thing is governments. And with government, we have really mixed feelings because on the one hand, we definitely don't want Big Brother. We know from, you know, history and other countries that it's a bad thing. But if you look at what happens at, you know, San Francisco airport or any airport for the matter, to help protect our country from terrorism, like, what do they go by? Like, they go by the color of your skin, the country you come from, your gender, your race. I mean, they go by really, really rudimentary criteria, whereas they could have the ability to look at really simple things like, hey, are you calling terrorists? Or are you hanging out with terrorists? Which would be so much more reliable and so much easier on everybody, right? Mm. So we have very mixed feelings about that, obviously. But at the same time, if we were able to, instead of being divided, right, discuss and agree on policies, maybe we could use technology for good, right? And privacy is really sort of this vague, you know, overall scary notion. But practically speaking, there are some, you know, specific situations and cases and some clear answers and some not so clear.
Right. And it's really interesting too, to hear, you know, see like the generational perspective. Like when I think of, you know, pessimistically, these social media companies, it actually has nothing to do with privacy. And that's what a lot of people in my generation, I'm a millennial. And in a sense, what I agree with you, it really is beautiful. Like I'm going to be able to contact my childhood friends for, you know, you can stay in contact with them for your entire life. But at the same time, you know, there's this like really awesome quote, and it's from Chuck Palahniuk, and he just talks about Big Brother's not, you know, they're not watching you every moment you're awake. He's making sure you're distracted at all times and fully absorbed in something else so that your imagination withers. And that's what my generation, at least we worry about. But so we won't go down that rabbit hole.
No, we can actually, yeah. Cause I have a perspective on that. And I totally agree with you that the older generations doesn't realize that we've basically played a couple of cycles or a couple of generations where we've redistributed the cards and you know, what the, you know, kind of second half of the 20th century experimented is an unprecedented, like historically unprecedented level of an equal society where if you work hard and if, you know, you're a good person, generally speaking, you will be well regarded, you will do well in life. And the reality of the first half of the 21st century is not like that at all. So it's now we're seeing it and we're seeing, you know, second half of the 20th century compared to first half of the 21st century. But if you compare first half of the 21st century to a century before, right, like early 1900 or the 1800s, it's actually a lot more comparable where you have all these inequalities, all this control by, you know, governments, corporations, rich people, powerful people. So basically a very unequal society. And that's where we are today. And that you know, we can talk about that maybe another time. That is disgusting and it's, you know, unfortunate. But that's where we've come.
Yeah. So we'll take a little bit of a non sequitur and start talking about so Mighty Capital, your managing partner. And actually it does relate because you
it does.
You're trying to create products that count. And personally, that's a goal of mine, you know, with my company and it's something that I really admire. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. And thanks for noticing the connection because it is absolutely there. When I started Products That Count, so the, you know, quick story, because I want to go back to that count, right? I started Products That Count because when I wrote my book, Mobilized, on what makes a great product, I quickly realized that, you know, I had a perspective, and you know, the book captures it, but that also almost every product leader has an interesting perspective to share on what makes a great product. And so I started Products That Count initially as a dinner series at my house. And now it's one of the largest networks of product managers in the world. Hmm. And why Products That Count? Because the product that count, it counts in actually in the business metric way, like it makes money, it has many users, it's big, but it also counts because it changes life. And that's really important. And in fact, you know, I don't think you can have both. It goes back to our earlier conversation about the art and the science, right? You need to have both if you want to be very successful.
Mm-hmm. And so you're a venture capitalist, so to speak, and Products That Count is kind of your, your mission with this company. And how have you been able to, embed this into your portfolio companies and into your fund?
Yes. Great question. So products that, like, I was angel investing. I've been angel investing for many years. The Mighty Capital, my fund, started because Products That Count was growing so much that the partners that I was investing with and I decided, like, we saw there was an opportunity to do something different. And so we started this fund a couple of years ago. And, you know, we've received a good amount of press coverage that says, you know, we're inventing a new way of doing venture capital. And the reason being exactly this focus on products that count. So how it manifests itself is really on our approach. So we will invest at a later stage. We're not going to seed very, very early companies. We invest in companies that already have product market fit and they need to accelerate their go-to-market. And we help them do that. It's actually a very hard thing to do. I mean, a lot of people are trying to start companies and that's really hard. But the phase after that is even harder and there are fewer people who can, who have done it and who can help you get there. So, so that's where we play. But unlike some of our friends and colleagues in venture capital who will, you know, when you're at that growth stage, invest a huge amount of money to make sure that they make money. And then they will sometimes put the founder and the employees at risk. We invest a very small amount of money and we look to add a maximum amount of value. And the value is access to the Products That Count network. And why it's valuable to our portfolio companies, three reasons. One is product managers, they make great hires. They're very hard to hire and find. Two is they also buy or influence the purchase decision of many, many tech companies. You know, if you have a product that does like any sort of analytics, any sort of like many of the B2B SaaS product, the chief product officer, the VP product is an influencer in the purchase decision. So some of our portfolio companies say they've generated millions of dollars in revenue because we gave them access to, you know, hundreds of thousands of product managers. And then the third value to our portfolio is many of them will exit via M&A, merger and acquisition. And generally at large tech companies, the chief product officer, the VP product is the one who initiates the M&A decision, right? They'll say, I want to buy this company. Here, corporate development team, like, make the deal happen for me. But they initiate that. So they're also very valuable.
All right. So that's kind of an alternative way of doing venture capital. And I like that. You know, you're almost, I think of, you know, like sports and coaching, you know, if someone were to hire you as their coach, it's like hiring a pitching expert, you know, as the head coach, right? So you guys come in and your team and you specifically know product. So you come in and you can offer that to help bridge the gap.
We do that and we offer access. So think of us as almost a niche marketing channel for your company. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. So, so I know that you had the chance to talk to Jeffrey Moore. This was a couple of years ago. So we've talked about Crossing the Chasm multiple times on this podcast. It's an excellent book. It's like actually right next to me on my desk. So just it's wondering,
right behind my book.
Oh, really? You covered it over. So do you have anything that maybe if it's a takeaway from that book or other favorite books that you offer, really just things that, an entrepreneur who's building a business and trying to cross that chasm?
Yes. Yes. You know, one of the key learnings from me from that book is the very beginning, right? Getting your few customers, getting things off the ground and reaching that product market fit. So being on the edge of crossing, right, is very, very slow, right? So it takes a really long time. You have to make your customers very, very happy and so on and so forth. But once you're on your way over to, you know, the chasm, then you're inside this tornado and you have to go as fast as you can. And sometimes that means that you're going to, you know, make a few people unhappy. And that transition from you get product market fit to you're reaching scale is a very hard transition. So, you know, the learning for me and for a lot of entrepreneurs in our portfolio is company building is not a linear process at all. There's phases where you go very slow, phases where you go very fast, and you need both. It's not linear.
Huh, that's an interesting perspective. I haven't really heard of it that way before. So two last questions. And they're ones that I ask everyone. And so I'll give you one and then we'll pause on it. I'll give you time to think. So if you could reach, you know, people wake up in the morning and they check their phone, right? You could reach 1 million people tomorrow, you know, with a message. What would it say? And I can give you a second to think on that while I ask for, do you have any specific like book suggestions, you know, that or movies, documentaries, things that they could be anything, things that you love, that could be fiction, you know, just it's good to hear from various perspectives.
We'll start with books and newsletter.
Sure.
All right. So a book I love, we already talked about, it's Jeffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm. I think for business building, it's fantastic. Another book that I really love, again, for business, but maybe more personal growth, is First Break All the Rules. Because I really do believe that, you know, breaking rules in a smart way is very well serving for, you know, hardworking, ambitious people. I'm not saying that as in like, don't care about rules. You want to care about rules, but know when to break them and when to follow them. Mm-hmm. And then another book that I really, really like, and that I would say is more relevant if you have a team and you're wanting to develop them and develop yourself as a leader, is the Enneagram book. Enneagram is an approach to defining your personality and other people's personality that I really, really love because it takes into account your environment. So it says you are a certain person in this kind of environment, like an environment where you strive versus a different kind of person if you're in an environment where you're stressed out. And so it really captures the fact that if you put yourself in the right environment, you're going to be, you know, a person you want to be. And in the wrong kind of environment, you're going to see yourself become a different person. So I really love that. And then newsletters and blogs that I read, in addition to Products That Count, of course, is I read Seth Godin daily. And I found it oddly, incredibly inspirational. It's not always, you know, related to what I'm going through, but the words of wisdom, the humor, the beautiful writing, I really appreciate.
Yeah, he's amazing. Seth's like one of my favorite entrepreneurs.
And then the words of wisdom to 1 million people. So I would say there. Let me start. So if I could talk to a million people, I would advise them to reinvent themselves constantly. Mm-hmm. When I had the privilege to hear John Chambers, the former CEO and chairman of Cisco, talk very recently, and he said, when I was at Cisco, I used to aim to reinvent the company completely every 5 to 7 years. And now I advise companies to reinvent themselves completely every 3 years or so. And what that tells you is that the world is going so fast and changing so rapidly that you want to be able to, you know, kind of reinvent yourself at that pace. Whether you're working for a big corporation, whether you're building your own business, you want to constantly refresh your skills. And the one skill that I would say you need if you want to be, you know, successful in life and business is sales. Selling not in the sense of like, here's my trinket, you should take it, but rather, let me find some way to add value to your life or your business and deliver that value. So very, very, you know, pragmatic and service value oriented. I think that if you understand that, you can do pretty much anything. You can build a business, you can, you know, build a great life, a great, great family, and be very, very successful because you're going to put others' needs as your top priority.
Right. That's certainly a good way to create a foundation. So reinvent yourself constantly.
That's right.
Thank you, Essie. Right. This is amazing.
Yeah, it was really fun. I enjoyed the questions. They were great questions.
Appreciate it. All right, everyone. Talk to you soon.